Well, good morning. This is lesson 18, miscellanies number 3 on money, wealth, work, and the poor from Proverbs. So some of these topics have already been, we've already begun the investigation or discussed, so we'll review those texts, but not going to spend much time on them this morning. One of the early lessons in Proverbs was on indolence, the avoidance of activity or exertion, laziness. So I thought the synonyms for indolence were good to put in our minds. So laziness, idleness, slothfulness, the sloth, shiftlessness, inactivity, inaction, inertia, sluggishness, lifelessness, lethargy, languor, languidness, torpor, torpidity. So those are picturesque words. Those are beautiful words to think about. And we first saw Proverbs, this topic of indolence, in Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 11. Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. I've often wondered how useful it would be to change my alarm tone for waking to Proverbs 6, 9 through 11, and just hear Alexander Scorby saying that quietly in the background, asking, "How long will you slumber, O sluggard?" Oh no, it's him again, I better get up. When will you rise from your sleep? Well, pretty soon. I'm a little tired right now. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. And then it should escalate, I think, toward the end. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Snooze. So that might be what we need is Alexander Scorby reading this passage to us. So I don't want to spend much time on this passage. We've already looked at it in depth a few weeks back, so I refer you to that information. But that's not all Proverbs has to say about being industrious and diligence and laziness. So we're going to look at a number of verses today. And what I really hope to do this morning, I don't have a lot of exegetical comments about these passages, but I'd like for you to think about these images and let these images rest and solidify inside you so that they form a picture to help guide your thinking. So that's the idea we're going to have for a good part of this lesson, just due to the volume of the scriptures in front of us. So on the topic of laziness, Proverbs 10:26, and these are in but largely in no particular order other than where we find them in Proverbs. So Proverbs 10:26, as vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the lazy man to those who send him. So I'm sure everyone here has had smoke in their eyes, right? Is that something everybody's had sitting around a campfire or being over at Will's house while he's cooking? You got smoke in the eyes. But what about vinegar to the teeth? What's the sensation that comes to mind for vinegar to the teeth?
You have a sore tooth or an infection that the vinegar really hurts.
So it's rather painful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the idea of there being a person who's like this, that you've got working for you, this, you know, whoever it is, we don't know who he is, he's been tasked with delivering something, right? So he gets this guy and says, "I want you to go deliver this letter, message, parcel, job, whatever." And he's a lazy man. And so the guy he ended up hiring just brings a painful sensation to him. Whenever I give him a job to do, it's a painful sensation. So Proverbs 13:4, the soul of the lazy man desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. So what do you picture when you imagine the lazy man desiring? What comes to mind?
Envy.
What's that?
Envy.
Envy. Oh, that's helpful. Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. Proverbs 15:9, the way of a lazy man is like a hedge of thorns, but the way of the upright is a highway. So here we have a contrasting proverb, right? We see it most normally with this but in the second half of the stanza there. The way of the lazy man is like a hedge of thorns. How is the way of a lazy man like a hedge of thorns? What's the hedge of thorns? Well, first of all, what is the hedge of thorns being contrasted to in this verse?
The highway.
The highway, that's right. So, why a hedge of thorns? Why is the way of a lazy man like a hedge of thorns?
Would they get through the path if there are thorny bushes all around the narrow path?
It's painful to him, that's right. Yeah, I think it is this obstacle, and the obstacle there is that he's not done anything to remove that hedge of thorns. You know, he's not doing anything, as Jeff mentioned, to better himself. He's living with just the desires of wanting to be like people.
He hasn't dug it up and burned it.
That's right. He hadn't even used Roundup. Proverbs 19:24, a lazy man buries his hand in a bowl and will not so much as bring it to his mouth again. You know, some of these proverbs can be chewed on for a long, well, no pun intended here, chewed on for a long time in thinking through the picture of a man who is so lazy that the only effort he can exert is to put his hand into the bowl. And he can't be made to bring it back out and feed himself. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture.
Dave, on 15:19... I think it's oftentimes if you meet people who have a lot of problems, they're impoverished. It may or may not be because they're lazy. You know, for various reasons. But often people who are lazy are impoverished.
That's right.
And you often find if you meet them, like say midlife, that you can make suggestions to them, but there's problems with everything. And they're not necessarily, it's not like you may get to the one about the lion in the street. It's not necessarily of their own imagination, but rather it's things that have built up over time, various problems that they have that can't be readily remedied, you know. And it's oftentimes not even just some money would fix the problem, but it's just you get set in a certain ways. So, and it's just a... there can be problems that are built up over time. It's a little bit like my garage. But
no, you are exactly right. There is a mindset of people who everything in life is a problem, but for them it's not a problem to be solved. It's a problem to be stared at and avoided. And it really is very important to learn that you're never going to get out of problems. Just solve them and move on. You're right. That's very good. Proverbs 20:4. The lazy man will not plow because of winter. He will beg during harvest and have nothing. So, you know, the lazy man not plowing because of winter, I've kind of wondered exactly what he's getting at here. And I think it's in a sense that it's not that he's unwilling to work. It's that he's unwilling to work that hard under those circumstances. The plowing in winter might be physically uncomfortable. And he just can't bring himself to work that hard. I'm willing to work, I just don't want to do that work. The desire in 21:25 of the lazy man kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. The desire kills him. That's really well said. The desire kills him. Proverbs 22:13, the lazy man says, there's a lion outside, I shall be slain in the streets. And we looked at that a few weeks back, and Jeff made reference to it here. There may or may not be a lion, it's true. But it's also true that you can imagine any number of problems that you simply will compel you to not work. So laziness is a serious problem for many, and Solomon has very picturesque warnings about being lazy. He also has a lot to say about diligence, so we're going to look at a few of the verses here. But what comes to mind when the word diligence is mentioned? How would you how would you define diligence?
Persistence.
Persistence, that's good. Yep. Persistence is very good. What else?
Working until the job's done.
Thoroughness, maybe? Bringing it to completion? Yeah, that's good. What else? I think you could also say there's a carefulness about it as well. Somebody who's diligent is paying close attention to what's before him. So diligence is critical in life. He who tills his land will be satisfied with bread, but he who follows frivolity is devoid of understanding. So the person who is easily distracted in his work, the person who is not exerting diligence by the careful persistence, I need to get this done and not be thinking about these things over here. The guy that's easily distracted in his task is devoid of understanding. We had a student at our school who once commented that it wasn't really his fault that he wasn't getting his jobs done, his schoolwork done, because he was attacked by daydreams. I thought it was the ultimate expression of victimhood. I was attacked by these daydreams. And the idea of following frivolity, of being easily distracted because this seems fun or interesting, has brought home. 27:18, whoever keeps the fig tree will eat its fruit, so he who waits on his master will be honored. So here's a proverb that's reinforcing, line B reinforces what line A has to say. And the keeping of trees, as anyone who's ever had an orchard will know, it's a lot of work. It's a multi-season set of tasks, you know, pruning at the right time, spraying, pinching fruit, watching the buds, watering. It really is takes a lot of work to make a vineyard. So it's not a one-time task. Keeping a fig tree takes effort. 28:19, he who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows frivolity will have poverty enough. And so we see a repetition of what we find in 12:11 there. Proverbs 27, largely from 10 through 29, we have Proverbs given in two-line stanzas, but there are times when those sections are longer, sometimes four, sometimes eight, there, sometimes three, and there's not much in the way of context through there, but there is in Proverbs 27, be diligent in starting in verse 23 to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in, the lambs will provide your clothing and the goats the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household and for the nourishment of your maidservants. So here, the diligence is being expressed in particular regarding your flocks and your herds. So obviously this person lives on a ranch. And the effort needed to maintain his holdings is significant. You need to know the state of your flocks. You need to attend to your herds. You need to be there. Well, why is that? Well, lots of things happen in life, and you might not know what's happening at all the times. Riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. Just because you've been endowed with some material blessing doesn't mean you'll be able to preserve that material blessing. You have to work to keep what you have, not just increase it, but you have to work very hard to keep it. So here's a picture before us of a wonderful blessing, that there's riches and there's a crown, and there's a harvest being made, and there's the shearing of the sheep to make wool. I mean, it's a large operation that takes a lot of work all the way through. So diligence is important, not just to get ahead, but also to preserve what you have. If you've got something, you need to make sure you keep something. So laziness and diligence are the first picture I wanted to look at today in understanding how to live the Proverbs life. Laziness and diligence. So a person might find himself desiring to be diligent and endeavoring to be diligent, and it comes. Proverbs also has a lot to say in the question of how do you conduct yourself in your work? What is your work ethic to look like? So part of your work ethic is whether or not you're industrious or whether you're lazy, but that's not the only part of your work life or your work ethic. So let's look at a few verses here that may, I hope, be easy to understand. In Proverbs 11:1, dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. Proverbs 16:11, honest weights and scales are the Lord's. All the weights in the bag are His work. Proverbs 20 and 23, diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and dishonest scales are not good. These are things that I would imagine most of us do not routinely do a lot of business or a lot of our commercial life with scales and weights anymore. But obviously people did for a long time. Although you might be surprised how important scales and weights are. But so what's being told to us about dishonest scales or dishonest weights? What are some of the pictures that come to mind to help us understand what Solomon had in mind when he wrote these? What were dishonest scales and weights in his day?
Used for the transfer of money. You have a certain amount of coinage for something, and if it's dishonest, they'd figure out a way to imbalance it so they'd get more money out of it than they should.
That's good.
Think of a story where some people would have tables that were just slightly shifted, not level, and then when they put their weight on there, it would unbalance it, but it didn't look like it was unbalanced.
Oh, I see. I hadn't heard that, yeah. Have you ever heard the phrase, having your thumb on the scale? The idea of pushing the direction one way or the other? Right.
So in a sense, when I think about it that way, it's like you could almost accidentally have a dishonest scale. If your table wasn't level and you didn't know it,
sure.
Be diligent to make sure you had a level table too.
That's important. Yeah, that's good. So where would we encounter scales and weights today?
Hey, before you go on to that, I was going to mention that I think, well, I've read anyways, that this is also a more of a problem for poor people. If you were wealthier, you might have your own weights to check. But the person who's really poor doesn't have any weight, just has to take the shop owner's word for it.
He has to trust. The poor man simply has to trust what the merchant is doing.
But when money came along, then everybody could get into the act because they clipped the coins.
Right, right, yeah. Money is a great leveler of dishonesty, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes. Randy?
Well, actually, in 2012, in one of the Republican debates for president, Proverbs 2023, Ron Paul brought that up in a campaign talking about the currency not being backed by gold or something. So he says, yeah, Proverbs 2023 says that diverse weights are abomination to the Lord. And, I mean, there was dead silence.
Yeah. I mean, sure.
No one even knew how to handle that.
So where else would we encounter weights and scales today?
By gasoline,
that's right.
Yeah.
Why do they put those little stickers on the gas pump? If you've ever seen the little stickers on the gas pump, yeah. You have not seen the sticker. Where have you been? Yeah, so there's little stickers that are put there by someone. Anyone know who does that? Anyone know who puts those little stickers on the pump?
Inspection.
Yeah, it's an inspection sticker. It's a state inspection sticker. Yeah. And why do they do that? What's the point?
Their honest feelings.
Well, what in particular, what are they trying to ensure?
The purity of the gas, right?
No. No.
The amount.
The amount. It's by volume, that's right. Nathan?
At a grocery store, the meat and the produce.
That's right. Yeah. Tearing weight is a big deal for those things. Now, our scales are such today that I don't know how much tampering takes place at, say, a Walmart deli or, you know, some counter. I'm not sure those types of tamperings are very material. But in manufacturing, manufacturing has a lot of problem with weights and measures, especially production environments where you're selling some product. So whether you're anything that's filled in a can or a jug, when you read the ingredients, it says it's got X number of ounces on it. Well, how do you know that you've got X number of ounces? Measuring those things and accounting for the variance is quite complex, and making sure that you've got the right amount, that you're not shortchanging people is a big deal.
I think also the manufacturer's packaging.
Yeah, right.
Because I bought what I thought was 2.5 pounds of frozen hash browns, and I get it home, and there's not 2.5 pounds of hash browns in that package, because I weigh it out on my scales. I need to make sure it's exactly 2.5 pounds for a recipe, and it's often 2.25 or
sure.
something like that.
Yeah, variance is actually a big deal in manufacturing, trying to figure it out. It's not very easy. Well, let's look at the next section there, deceit and dishonesty. Proverbs 13:11, wealth gained by dishonesty will be diminished, but he who gathers by labor will increase. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, this is 20:17, but afterward his mouth will be filled with gravel. Proverbs 21:6, getting treasure by a lying tongue is the fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. That's really strongly worded, isn't it? If you are attempting to increase your wealth by a lying tongue, you are someone who is seeking death. I think 2017 might be the most picturesque, that bread, stolen bread, is sweet to a man, but afterwards his mouth will be filled with gravel. The taste, the long-lasting taste of stolen bread is gravel.
I have a perfect illustration of that.
What is that?
One of my relatives was in a car accident that was her fault. And so she and the family paid for the repairs and so on of the other driver. 5 years later, the question was, well, are we going to close this case or not? And the man, as a lawyer, said, yeah, I want to bring it up again, because I think you are actually using your cell phone, texting on your cell phone. Well, she had her father with her in the car. And no, she wouldn't have been texting her father in the car. And also, there were no, he was claiming all sorts of medical expenses, et cetera, et cetera. Couldn't prove it. Went to court, jury case, and they tried to settle out of court. Said, look, you're suing us for $120,000. Look, we'll give you $5,000, and you can just walk away with it. We'll be done with it. Said, no. I think we can do this, and that he was very disrespectful. Anyway, he thought he could get $120. The judge said, "Look, if you're going to continue with this without any proof, without any respect for me, you're going to lose your license your legal license." And he said, "No, I'm going to pursue this." So he did, and he lost the case, and he lost his license. He thought he could get
$120,000
real quick there.
Yeah. Well, it's tempting, isn't it? I one of the things I appreciate about 13:11 here is the parallelism, that wealth gained by dishonesty. So in his mind, he's trying to gather wealth. That's the idea behind line B, he who gathers by labor. So those are the contrasts, but there's a certain symmetry to it, right? So both of them are trying to increase, but the guy who's increasing by dishonesty is actually decreasing, and he doesn't know it. He doesn't sense it. He's working hard to increase things, but actually he's decreasing all the while, whereas the man who's using industry and labor is the one who's honestly increasing.
Dave? in popular culture, we have this concept that's imported from, I suppose it's Indian religion, it's called karma.
Right.
And when I read this, I think, well, a couple of these verses are kind of, they sound, you know, the idea is similar, so
right.
Maybe karma... Is it completely? You know?
Oh, we're on dangerous ground. I need to pause the recording here, folks. If there's a long set of silence, there's a perpetrator in our midst who needs to be dealt with. So I have a better suggestion coming up. So we'll look at that. So here's a section about not only dishonesty but preying on your neighbor. So Proverbs 20:14, it is good for nothing, cries the buyer, but when he's gone his way, then he boasts. So what's happening here when you're trading with someone? What's the strategy involved with 20:14?
Pastor Parnell is negotiating with
a
street vendor.
Well, yeah, you're trying to get the lowest price possible, and you're saying, oh, gee, you're really ripping me off at this level. And so the vendor will say, no, I'm not. But then if they come in somewhere between, the guy walks away and said, I really got a great deal.
You know, that's right. But in a sense, one of the real problems here is it's not that he's driving for a hard bargain. It's he says it is good for nothing. It's the fact that he took this man's goods, and his assessment is it's good for nothing. It's a dishonest assessment, and it's the preying on this man by disparaging his goods, which is being commented on. It's not the fact that he drove a hard bargain. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, a guy can always decide he doesn't want to do business with you. But it's lying about the nature of the goods. It's disrespecting what the man has to sell. Proverbs 28:8, one who increases his possession by usury and extortion gathers it for him who will pity the poor. That is beautiful. So what is usury? We talked about usury. I think we talked about usury for a little bit. But what, generally speaking, what's usury?
Well, like an exorbitant interest rate that is really not commanded by the market.
That's an exorbitant interest rate not commanded by the market. That's the common idea today, and often the legal idea of usury. I'm not sure I buy it, but that's the legal idea. So certainly, it was forbidden in the Old Testament to charge interest on, say, charitable loans. If your brother was destitute and in need, you could loan him money, but you weren't allowed to charge him business for it, or charge him interest for it. And charging him interest was an act of usury. Today it's sort of morphed into high interest. So you'll find that often people with payday loans, for instance, are spoken of in the most negative light about charging usurious rates, and it turns out they don't. If you want to investigate that, you'll feel sorry for the payday lenders because they really are providing a valuable service, but they're despised. I remember one base where the commanding officer said that ordered his troops not to use the payday lending services, that they weren't allowed to go off base and use these guys because he felt they were so treacherous. Again, both of them are usury and extortion. What's extortion? Let's tidy this one up. What's extortion?
Any type of blackmail.
It's a sort of blackmail, not necessarily though. Doesn't
extortion is when it's like blackmail, but instead of preying on the person's weakness, you're creating the weakness. You're threatening them or threatening to do something that goes beyond blackmail.
That's right. There's usually some threat of violence or severe cost to be incurred by not complying with them. And the reason I think usury and extortion are put here is that you're not honestly trading. You're not exchanging and increasing value. You're using intimidation or you're preying on someone one way or the other. You're the bully when you're employing these things. And Proverbs condemns this wholesale. And in fact, it's similar to what we saw about the guy who's gathering by deceit. The guy who gathers by usury and extortion It's not that it's diminishing. He's gathering it for someone who will give it to the poor. So here we see an idea of God being in charge of these transactions, and he knows what's happening. He's watching what's happening. And if you're going to use usury and extortion, well, then I'll simply move the money over here and take it from you in a way you can't perceive. So there's a sense of scheming against your neighbor. In 22:28, do not remove the ancient landmark which your fathers have set. Actually, an important proverb, and we'll talk a little bit about why that's important here in just a second. 23:10-11, do not remove the ancient landmarks. This is in a different section. Nor enter the field of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is mighty, and he will plead their cause against you. 29:13, the poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives light to the eyes of both. Deuteronomy 19:14, this idea of the landmark, you shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. And 27:17, cursed is the one who moves his neighbor's landmark, and all the people shall say, Amen. So I'd like to read these two excerpts from commentator Wardlaw, who I think does a good job of summarizing what the dangers are of the ancient landmark, why it's still important for us today to be thinking in these terms. The act is one of detestable deceit and fraud. A man may, by his means, if he goes about it cautiously and by degrees and chooses carefully his opportunities, and especially when he has to do with one who is somewhat careless and unobservant in such matters, add to the border of his own inheritance and thus benefit himself and his family. So here's a guy who's sort of scheming in the background, looking to see, is this guy paying attention to his borders? Does he really know where these landmarks are at? Does he really understand what's going on? And through careful plotting, is looking to move that landmark so he can increase his field at the expense of his neighbor who might not notice it. He says, but it, that is the encroaching upon his neighbor's border, is in a way which the God of truth and righteousness abhors. Let everyone bear in mind that how cleverly, ingeniously, and successfully soever this may be effected, and how secretly soever, from the eyes of all living, that he eludes the detection of the defrauded, of himself and of his relations, his friends, his creditors, and the public authorities to whom it has been given in charge to search out frauds and to right the injured, yet it is not unknown. So no matter how good the scheming is of the guy didn't catch me when I moved the border, his neighbors didn't catch me, his creditors didn't catch it, nobody, the authorities didn't catch it, I think I've gotten away with it. Wardlow continues that it is not an unseen act. The eye sees it, to which the darkness and the light are both alike. Every inch of land, every fraction of wealth so acquired, has the curse of the just one upon it. So this idea that of scheming against your neighbor is related to the praying and the deceit, in that you think you're going to get away with something, and you know you might in the transaction itself. But God's the one who sees what's happening, and he's not going to allow that wealth to continue forever. And this idea of the Lord gives light to the eyes of both, that this picture of the eyes is important in dealing with wealth, that God is the one who is watching all that we do. All right, well, we're running a little low on time, and I want to run through this. I'm not going to spend much time on this next section, but in 2017, this is why these are the miscellanies, because they're random. In 2017, it said, bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth is filled with gravel. And it got me thinking about the sweetness of what has been acquired or accomplished, in this case, by deceit. And the idea of sweetness as an allurement is a dominant theme in Proverbs. I really hadn't thought much about it, but if you recall in Proverbs 9, when the woman of the house of folly is enticing her neighbors to come, the only taste that she mentions, as contrasted with the house of wisdom, is sweetness. It's the stolen waters are sweet, right? Now, the House of Wisdom says, no, I've butchered the meat, spices, it's aromatic. There's a different taste sensation. But the folly looks at sweetness as something as all she can muster to entice people. And it got me thinking about the idea of sweetness in the book of Proverbs. And it's really found in quite a few places. So I wanted to do a brief survey on the idea of sweetness. There are a couple, three different words, I think, used to describe sweetness or translated sweetness. Some of it is just pleasant or delight or a pleasantness. It's not necessarily sweetness in a glucose-related fashion, but something you might delight in. And the reason this is important is, yes, the wicked are imitating the God-given delight and pleasantries of the world by offering things that are sweet because they're stolen. But that's not the way sweetness and pleasantness is described throughout the book of Proverbs. So in 2:10, when wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant, or perhaps some have said even sweet, pleasant to your soul or sweet to your soul. 3:24, when you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down and what? Your sleep will be sweet. 9:17, stolen water is sweet and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. 13:19, a desire accomplished, getting something done that you've been hoping to do is sweet to the soul. But it is an abomination of fools to depart from evil. 16:21 and 24, the wise in heart will be called prudent, and sweetness of the lips increases learning. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. So here we find the repetition, almost ready to knock you over. How many times does Solomon have to use it in one verse to get you to see that he wants life to be sweet and pleasant? Proverbs 20:17, we looked at bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man. So sweetness and pleasantness are important. 24, both 13 and 25, my son, eat honey because it is good, and a honeycomb which is sweet to your taste. But those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. So in a sense, he's saying those who are in the practice of rebuking wickedness will have sweetness, will have delight and pleasantness. 27, both 7 and 9, a satisfied soul loathes the honeycomb, but to a hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet. The hungry person can look at something bitter and derive sweetness out of it. Oil and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. Again, the ideas keep coming and rushing over you. When you read the book of Proverbs, you should walk away with a sense of not merely lots of rules and minutiae, but these pictures should hit you that Solomon wants you to live a sweet and rich life. The way and the path of wisdom is a way of sweetness. It's a way of delight. So we'll continue on here about acquiring wealth. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10, honor the Lord with your possessions and the first fruits of all your increase, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. The idea behind the pursuit of wealth should always have as a foundation that it's honoring God to build wealth. God is delighted when His people build wealth. There's nothing wrong with building wealth. There's something wrong with having wealth own you, but there's nothing wrong with building wealth, and you should honor God through each step of this endeavor. 11:28 is a powerful reminder that he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like foliage. So again, it's a picture of thriving, of a plant that's coming to life. And if you're trusting in riches, which sounds like something other people do, but if you're trusting in riches, the security that comes from having much in the way of material possessions, you're going to fall. That's the long and the short of it. And in Proverbs 23:4 and 5, I don't want to say so much that we're trying to temper the idea of diligence. I don't really like that idea. But there's a clear warning. Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. This is a picture all of you, I hope, will have firmly imprinted upon your mind. The idea of overworking. He didn't say do not work to be rich. Do not overwork to be rich. Don't have material possessions as such an exclusive and important goal that you're willing to sacrifice the righteousness and peace and sweetness of your life just for the pursuit of filthy lucre, as I like to say. But then, what are you setting your eyes on? Again, Solomon is not so sophisticated that he won't imply pretty mundane imagery to get you to think about something. So in your endeavors to overwork to be rich, when you get to verse 5, what he's really saying is, what do you have your eyes set on when you're trying to be rich? What's the end goal? What's in mind for you? And in verse 5, we're reminded, are you going to set your eyes on that which is not? You might think, well, that's kind of silly, because it obviously is. I mean, I can see it. I'm acquiring wealth. But just like the man who was growing his wealth through deceit, but he was actually diminishing his wealth through all of his efforts, Solomon is giving a pretty clear warning that you really don't know what's behind your material possessions. You really don't know how long it will last. It can fall. It can completely collapse before your eyes. And he doesn't use the imagery of it cascading into a hole, which I think I might have done. You know, it can just fall apart. No. Riches, what do? Well, they give themselves wings. Right? Boom! They got wings. You ever tried to catch a bird and fly? They hit the wings, and what happens? You get to watch it fly away like an eagle to heaven, staring up in the sky. You know, it doesn't go away right away. It just gets away right away. But it doesn't go away. It goes away right there. There he is. I can still see him, and he's still going. How did he get the wings? That's the part I don't understand. I wonder if he's coming back. He's not a homing pigeon. He's not going to come back and visit. He's going to heaven with your riches. Taking your riches to heaven. Probably to unburden your soul so it won't keep you heavy laden. Right? That's the idea. Solomon severely warns against the acquisition of wealth at the cost of your righteousness. All right. I wish we had a lot of time. I'm only going to read a few of these. Solomon really does spend a lot of time thinking about the poor. He does. Proverbs 11, there is one who scatters yet increases. There is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. It's the generous soul that's made rich. So Proverbs 11, 24 to 26. Proverbs 19, 17, he who has pity on the poor is lending to the Lord. That's a beautiful picture. If you lend to God, is there any risk involved of getting your money back? He always pays a reasonable rate of return, and he always makes his payments. Be generous to the poor. Proverbs 22:9, he who has a generous eye will be blessed. Proverbs 28:27, he who gives to the poor will not lack. That doesn't even make sense. You give away what you've got to the poor, you'll not have any lack. 29:7, the righteous considers the causes of the poor. And in Proverbs 22:22-23, do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. For the Lord will plead their cause and plunder the souls who plunder them. So this idea of being afflicted at the gate is where the transactions would take place. It's in the marketplace where people would have gathered. So if you're there with an eye set to robbing the poor, what you'll find is that they have an advocate who's looking out for them. Now, you have to negotiate with God. Right? He's the one who's upset with you. He's the one pleading their case. And he's going to win. And in fact, when he enters into judgment against you, he intends to plunder you. Because he plunders your soul. Because you were the one that plundered the poor. Proverbs has a lot to say about treating the poor kindly and having an eye, especially having an eye to the poor. It's the righteous one who's considering. He's looking and seeing the plight to those around him. It's an important message in the book of Proverbs. All right, we're at the end. I don't want to paint such a rosy picture of work and diligence that you think Solomon... Well, he was a king. He was too far detached from everyday life. He really wasn't. There's one proverb that I've treasured for years, and the Yiddish like it as well. Proverbs 14:4, where no oxen are, the trough or the manger is clean. But much increase comes by the strength of an ox. And the Yiddish would say, all is not butter that comes from a cow. Right? So, I don't want to paint the picture here that everything you do when it comes to work is pretty, smells good, and is pleasant to be around, right? There are distasteful elements about all the labor we have under the sun. And you just gotta work through it. And realize that those problems are really benefits. Because if you didn't have them, you'd be completely overcome and you'd become lazy. You wouldn't be able to work through them. But the promise is, much increase comes by the strength of an ox. So get in there and clean out the barn and just put up with it. Alright. Any comments or questions?
God's pleading the case of the poor, I think, is part of that answer to karma.
That's right. Thank you for bringing us back and setting Jeff in his rightful place. God's the one that pleases. He's the one that has eyes on the poor always at all times. So,
is that on the passage about the first fruits, is that primarily just pointing to the tithe, or is it the tithe plus alms? What is exactly meant by the first fruits there?
I think there's a number of things behind it. I think it would certainly include that first fruits, I think, has an obvious meaning that way. But it also has the meaning of being reflective in how you're acquiring your wealth. That you're not being overly enamored with it, nor entrapped by it. That you're doing this because God's called you to work, and He's called you to earn so that you can give to the poor. So it has, I think, maybe a little broader context behind it. But it would include that. Yes?
Robert Frost, I think, said, good fences make good neighbors.
That's right. Yeah. I met a guy last night who told me that there had been some property sold around his house, and they had to get it resurveyed. And his yard expanded by 35 feet one direction and 25 feet another direction. And he, as best he could tell, the ancient landmark, because I'd already written this lesson, I was thinking, do not remove the ancient landmark. But in this case, the authorities moved the ancient landmark because the landmark was wrong. But it had been in place since the 20s, I believe, when they platted this area. So sometimes the ancient landmark is wrong, but, you know, a good fence establishes a good boundary and makes for good neighbors and keeps contention far away. All right, any other comments or questions?